Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today I'm excited to welcome back to the show former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Catherine Alston Fitts. Now, Catherine's many years on Wall Street and in the halls of government have given her a unique perspective and a deep understanding of some of the real causes and motivations behind the alarming headlines that we've been seeing lately. Now, Catherine's latest Solari report details the challenges that the new Trump administration is facing, and the variety of deep state forces that are arrayed against change. Today, she'll give us her analysis of the strange U-turns in his policy that President Trump is making. Are the neocons getting the upper hand so soon? Here we go. Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Catherine Alston Fitts, the Black Budget Wars, the Deep State, Trump, and North Korea Roulette.
The whole central banking warfare model is unraveling, and they literally don't know how to keep it going without a major war.
The Dark Journalist Black Budget Wars Special Report. The Deep State, Trump, and North Korea Roulette. Featuring an in-depth, two-part interview with former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Catherine Alston Fitts. Now, let's go join Dark Journalist Daniel List.
Catherine, it's great to have you back.
That's great to be back, Daniel. Happy spring.
Yeah, well, it's getting very interesting, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, we have so much to cover, but let's start with what's on everyone's mind, which is the apparent U-turn by President Trump on Syria, having fired these missiles into one of their air bases. Now, Trump's official policy before that was very different, some would say diametrically opposed from the Obama-Clinton policy. Trump didn't seek the removal of Assad from power in Syria. So very different approaches there. But now, suddenly, that's all changed.
Well, but let's just talk about 59 Tomahawk missiles. We know about approximately half never got through.
Yeah.
What's that about? Trump gave the Russians and Syrians an hour notice.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't harm the runway because we know they're taking off shortly thereafter for other military purposes. So we didn't harm the runway. Half didn't get through. The Russians and Syrians had an hour notice.
Right.
I mean, it's almost like a Hollywood set.
Mm-hmm.
So the question was, what was that really?
What was it really? Yes, that's the question. And that includes the original chemical attack. We still don't know where that originated from. So blaming Assad, basically with no evidence, seems very odd to me. You know, usually these things require some kind of public proof before we start bombing. They have to be verified, right?
Well, but Daniel, we're in a post-fact world. We have fake science, fake news, and now fake intel. So there's an MIT professor who gave an interview on RT that was very wonderful because he was so disturbed that he read the thing that the White House published about a declassified intelligence report. And it's basically, you know, Yahya, and he's going, oh, my God, you can't have, you know, now he's contemplating a world of fake intel. But so we don't know. First of all, we don't know what happened. So the allegation is sarin gas. Looks to me like it was something else, but. You know, I'm not a sarin gas expert, but I think Michael Savage's comment that if it had been sarin gas, why weren't those relief workers wearing gloves? They'd be dead. So that's a good question. So the first question is, what was it? Then the second question is, who did it? I'm in the Ron Paul camp. He said there's zero chance Assad did it. Now, that's not to say that somebody didn't, you know, do a deal with one of his military people who's not, I mean, so something covert happened. We're looking at a covert operation. There's no way Assad did it. He'd be crazy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Robert Perry had a very interesting story saying it was Israeli-Saudi operation using a drone. That makes a lot of sense. So I would give that a reasonable probability of being true. The question is, who are they working for?
Right.
Are they working for a portion of the American deep state? Or are they working for the City of London? And I would say if you look at the back and forth for the last 2 weeks, it looks to me like a third party is trying to start World War III.
Yeah.
So my guess is it was a third party doing the gas attack. It was a third party doing the bombing of the St. Petersburg, you know, subway. It to me, this looks like a third party who's trying to get the 7 countries in 5-year plan kicked back into operation and start World War III with Russia, because they're sitting there and the whole central banking warfare model is unraveling. And they literally don't know how to keep it going without a major war.
Well, Catherine, let's go a little deeper on this, because I'm thinking about this third party, you know, the X factor, this deep state faction out there. And I'm wondering, what could they be so afraid of that they would take us to the brink of war?
Believe it or not, I think their number one fear is pedophilia, because the way the model unravels is not just the economic unravel. They can deal with the economic unravel. But when the Midianite thing happens within the establishment, you get a major pedophilia scandal going, and then they're all turning against each other, and then the whole thing really unravels.
I see.
And I think they're worried about not being able to keep the establishment team, you know, functioning and operating together. It was interesting, on the first quarter wrap-up, I went through the whole cabinet and sub-cabinet group and said, okay, is this guy a Titanic Turner? Is this guy a scaredy cat? Is this guy a scorpion? Is this guy a piggy? And what you realize is, because we all have a little of every, you know, we're all a little bit of everything in us. Mm-hmm. What you realize is a good pedophilia scandal, and you can turn a whole bunch of Titanic Turners into piggies and scorpions. See what I mean?
Interesting. Yeah. Well, let's sum up your 4 archetypes there from the report. And these are particularly interesting. The Titanic Turners are those who see the opportunity to turn things around for America. The piggies are those who are trying to turn any situation to their financial advantage. The scaredy cats, and we have a lot of those, are those who know about the missing money and the lack of accountability in the system, and they want to flee before the mob gets to them and the situation turns. And then there's scorpions, the Dick Cheney, Hillary Clinton types, who have a psychopathic tendency towards destruction. Very compelling categories there for sure. So your point here is that those coming in to turn things around can get persuaded against it pretty easily with the right scandal.
And the thing can really turn.
Right.
Now, I'll tell you, I don't know if you saw that picture of the decision room down at Mar-a-Lago. So the president's down in Florida with Xi Jinping for the summit, and Tillerson's down there with him, and they have a decision room, the picture taken with Syria. Other than McMaster, there's no military or intel.
Now, we highlighted McMaster in our last episode, and I've been calling him General Strangelove, because ever since he got elevated, we seem to be inclined to handle all of our problems militarily. So go ahead and give us a picture of what we have there in this decision room.
It looks like a board meeting at Rothschild Inc. You have Wilbur Ross, who worked at Rothschild for 24 years. He's right there. You got, you know, the team from Goldman. You've moved, I don't know if you, you've moved Bannon out of the national security, and you've put in a Goldman partner. I don't know if you know the history of Dina Powell.
Oh, yeah, but go ahead and tell us here.
Oh, let me explain the history of Dina Powell. She's a piece of work. So her family is Egyptian, came to this country, but she speaks Arabic. Apparently she was working, and I'm just describing, what I'm telling you is from a description she gave at a conference of her history. So this is based on Dina Powell's world. So she is in the White House at 9/11 and speaks Arabic. So she said she's one of 25 people who with an Arabic background and speak Arabic, who have classification when 9/11 hits. So she goes to work for Condoleezza Rice, helping to engineer the 7 Arabic countries in 5 years plan that kills over 1 million Arabs.
Wow.
Yay!
Right, yeah.
So then she goes to New York to work at Goldman Sachs. She and her husband get plum jobs in New York and are able to buy a $3.3 million condo.
Wow.
Coming out of government. Yes, wow. Talk about being grateful for engineering the, you know, the genocide of 1 million Arabs.
Yeah.
So the boys were very grateful. She goes to Goldman Sachs, and her job is socially responsible initiatives. And she puts together or leads an initiative of, it's called 10,000 Women. And during the bailouts, when you have people getting thrown out of their home and the country collapsing, you go into Goldman Sachs' website, and on the homepage, here's a big picture of a big African woman with African dress smiling, and it says 10,000 Women Initiatives.
Unbelievable.
So, She engineers socially responsible initiatives for women that help you basically foreclose on America and throw millions of women and children out of their homes, you know, but Goldman's looking good. And then she goes to run the foundation to do philanthropic initiatives for Goldman Sachs.
So, wow.
So this is a woman who puts lipstick on genocide.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to rev up the seven countries in 5 years. So she worked for Condoleezza Rice. So the Friday before the Syrian bombing, Condoleezza Rice comes to meet with the president. And suddenly, after the meeting, Bannon off the National Security Council, Dina Powell in the Security Council.
Amazing.
And when I saw that happen, I said, ooh, we're in trouble. We are in trouble because we're ready to put some more lipstick on genocide.
Wow, that really is cause for concern. But let's look at the optics of this again. So we've talked about who was there, who kind of shouldn't be. Now let's talk about who isn't there, who should be.
Well, when you look at the room, we don't have the head of the CIA in the room, but Dina Powell's in the room.
Fascinating.
You know, you got Gary Cohen, Steve Mnuchin, and Goldman Sachs, and you know my old Rothschild story from Wall Street.
Well, if it's the one I'm thinking of, you have to tell us.
There was a wonderful partner at Dillon Reed. So I was a partner at Dillon Reed. There's a wonderful partner at Dillon Reed whose father had been chairman of the firm. And he was the database on the history of Dillon Reed. He was our firm historian. He knew all where all the bodies were buried. Anyway, so Nick Brady was the chairman of the firm and went to be senator. Tom Kaine, when he was governor, appointed him to pick up the Senate seat for a period. It was an appointment. And he had brought in a guy to run Dillon Reed, a guy named John Berklin, who came from Rothschild, same place as Wilbur Ross. And he was very... You know, there was a common cultural meme that said, you know, a Nick guy. There was a certain kind of guy who was a Nick guy. And this guy wasn't a Nick guy. And I said to Brandy, this is so unusual. You know, Berklin's not a Nick guy. And Brandy looked at me like I was so stupid. You know, I was from the provinces. And he said, Nick didn't pick Berklin. You know, the Rothschilds picked him. I said, Jim, we own the firm. What do the Rothschilds have to do with us? And he looked at me like I was you know, it's like that look of, oh God, I knew we shouldn't have had a woman made a partner. You know, they just don't know how the world works. And he rolls his eyes and just walks off because he's not going to explain it. And I thought, oh my God, this is right out of a conspiracy theory or something. But basically what he was saying was, you know, the Rothschilds picked the guy who ran the firm, not the partners who own the equity.
Unbelievable.
You know, let alone the chairman of the firm. It's like, whoa. Anyway, that story, if you go to my online book, Dillon Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, that story's in the thing. But and that's why when I look at the picture of Mar-a-Lago, it's definitely the central banking side of the equation,
yeah,
not the warfare side. And that concerns me.
Well, I can appreciate that. And let's tackle here some of these rumors that are floating around that General Strangelove McMaster wants to put 150,000 U.S. troops on the ground in Syria. Now, just how bad is this idea for America?
You do not want to start a ground war that you're going to lose.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
You know, the chances that we lose that one, I don't mean to sound heartless, you know, because I can see everyone in my subscriber base saying, "Well, what about the you know, I'm very concerned with the humanitarian things." But
well, the truth is, we have a tendency to make things worse, not better, when we go in militarily. That's a fact.
Well, if the United States revives ground wars in the Middle East that they lose, you know, we are in very significant trouble, particularly when you look at the budget ramifications. We are all used to talking about all these different policies without a dynamic simulation of what the economics are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so here's Sam Huntington has a great quote where he says the West won because they were better at force. He said, the West doesn't think about that, but everybody else never forgets it. I'm paraphrasing. You know, if the West achieves its dominance by force, and then that force mechanism should fail openly, publicly, in a big way, then you're talking about a very ugly situation, because you're blowing the whistle for every nut and bully in the world to say, okay, have at it.
Right.
So
that's a great point.
I think that, right, if you look at the group that wanted to basically pull back and rebuild, they understand the importance of having a military that can perform. And that's why we did a report card for the Trump administration. And one of the things I said, you know, if you look at both accomplishments, and I called it material omissions and stumbles, we have got to have a vision for United States' role in the world, and then it's got to conform with what our military can do.
Yes.
So if the Navy are going to police the sea lanes of the world, they need the capacity to do that. And a war in the Middle East means we don't have the money to protect the capacity to do that. I remember Lawrence Wilkerson was on a commission saying this, if climate change means the water levels change, then you've got to reconfigure every port in the nation. Well, you know, if that money is going to drop bombs on Syria, then you can't do that. So That's why I say this is really, you know, it's all going to meet in the budget. And but there's a real sign to me of what's happening right now in the politics in Washington. You know, the central banking side does not see a way of getting from here to there without World War III. And to me, that is a failure of imagination. So we've got to come up with a way of moving down the road that doesn't require, you know, depopulating 100 million people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's disturbing. It's very disturbing. One thing I would say about that, though, is, well, let's just focus on the target for a moment, Syria. Why Syria?
Well, Syria, you know, if you look at the pipeline, in Syria is very strategically positioned on the Silk Road. And there are a couple questions. If you go back to Brzezinski's grand chessboard, who's going to be the hegemon on the Silk Road? Is it going to be the G7, or is it going to be somebody else? So part of this is we're talking about the most dynamic growth area in the world, who's going to be the hegemon? Because remember, you've got East Asia and China converging with Europe on a per capita basis, and that means that trade is going to be phenomenal. So Silk Road, very important. The second thing is you've got pipelines coming into Europe. On the day that the false flag happened, you had the EU approve the Nord Stream pipeline from Russia into Europe. So if you have a Qatar-Turkey pipeline that wants to happen, but it means going through Syria, and I'm assuming you can't do that without regime change, and that's one of the goals for regime change. And it's very important strategically who gets the gas sales into Europe, and number one, but number two, are they denominated in dollars, or, you know, if they're denominated in rubles, it's going to be something else, or euros, depending on how, you know, the Nord Stream pipelines work. So the pipeline politics are very, very important here. Syria is in a very physically strategic important situation, but remember, pipeline politics are very intimately involved with currency politics, because you know, right now the U.S. dollar is on an energy standards, as you will. I've always believed that the GMO thing was to try and move that to food. I think it's failed. And if you look at the pushback to say basically the pipeline politics that are going on in Syria, what do we have? It's back to the 7-country, 5-year plan, which to me was all about getting everyone in the tent so you could do a global currency.
Mm-hmm.
So this tiny little country is right at the heart of the war to build the infrastructure for a global currency.
And this goes right to the heart of the war on cash, which we're seeing more and more now. You know, they need this global currency because this is the real control mechanism. You know, they can't have countries like Russia, for example, opting out and creating their own SWIFT transaction systems, which is something they're doing now. You know, they have their own clearing infrastructure going on. So where does that leave the globalists who want a global digital currency?
A digital currency is a harvesting machine, okay? And if we look at the group that's leading, one of the things we know is they have an overhead problem. So you've covered this. We've talked about this many times. We've taken one civilization and we've created a financial mechanism that finances two civilizations at the same time without the first realizing it.
Right.
So think of it. Think of it like a man who is, you know, these men who create independent families. So they end up with two wives and two families and nobody realizes it. And they go back and forth, you know, say in different cities.
A double life.
So they're leading a double life. They got two families, two houses. So they have an overhead problem. They cannot afford for their revenues to go down because they have a big overhead.
Okay.
Okay. So this group is financing two families in two houses in secret, and they cannot afford for their revenues to dip. And if you look at the retreat of globalization, if you look at the, you know, sort of peak everything natural resource problem, what that means is their margins are shrinking and they're having a harder and harder time of making that nut.
Yes.
And so what do they need? They need more control and the ability to harvest on a very distributed basis over the whole planet if they're going to keep making that nut. They need more and more control. They can't envision a way of doing this without, you know, anything that does this with bottom-up optimization, Daniel, requires transparency, and transparency is not what they want. You know, if you've got, you do not want your two wives learning about each other.
Wow, that is fascinating and a great analogy. Now, this other group, this X factor, you know, this cloaked civilization, how are they doing? You know, are they thriving yet? Or how do you see it?
Go figure. I mean, you're, you know, everybody listening has as good information as I do. The only thing I see about that civilization is it's unbelievably expensive.
Yeah.
Now, they're hoping that the investment in space will really, and I think that's why the interest in asteroid mining, they really needed to start generating its own returns. Now, clearly, it's getting enormous dividends and interest. It's probably bought up just about everything on this planet. But this gets us back to the question of what is the hidden system of finance, and are we literally paying a dividend to another planet? There was a great moment in Jupiter Ascending. I think you saw it when the sister of the guy who owns Earth turns to the other person and says, Earth is just a very small part of a much bigger corporation. Now, if you look at the financial system, it's literally as though we're paying a tithe off planet, you know, and everything organizes around producing that tithe. And one thing, you know, if I could engage in very great conjecture, what I would say is, you know, the home office requires a 5% increase every year. And basically the guys running the central banking model cannot afford to not make the dividend. They have to make the dividend. And this is why the end of the debt growth model is so important, because the way to plug the system and get that dividend and keep everybody happy down on the farm was just to print more debt.
Absolutely.
And the reality is, you know, we came into the bailouts, the G7 had levered up, we did the bailouts, and then we had the emerging markets lever up, and they finished levering up, and now everybody's levered up. You know, your debt...
There's nowhere to go.
Debt capacity. Right. Well, there is a place to go. We can go to an equity model, and we can optimize bottom up, but that requires market... It requires a legitimate pricing function. And when you're trying to run the whole thing with fake intel, fake science, fake news, you know, the harvesting machine needs a new way to dig, and a digital currency and digital cash is that way. Mm-hmm. But you need all those countries in the tent, and you need the ability to force everybody into a digital system. That's why the guys from Bitcoin drive me nuts, because they think, oh, this is how we're going to be free. I said, no, you're prototyping Mr. Global's
digital currency.
Well, here's the thing. I've talked a lot about this. You know, you've seen that video with Aaron Rousseau. I try to get all of my subscribers to watch the video with Aaron Rousseau where he talks about the Rockefeller telling him, you know, we're going to chip everybody and the cash is going to be digital. And if they don't behave, we can turn off their money. And that's the plan.
Right.
So, you know, and if you look at everything that's happening, it's clear they're driving for that.
Oh, there's no question about it. But I'll tell you what's great about the full extent of your analysis is that I really feel, because you've been in governments, you know, under Bush Sr., at HUD, worked with Clinton, and on Wall Street, that you have a great handle and understanding on how these people think and what their goals are. So in light of all that, you know, what is the subtext, the hidden agenda behind this huge effort for this one world global currency?
A couple years ago, and there's a review of this up on the Solari Report, I read a fabulous book by a professor of Cornell who went back and really unpacked the economics of the American slave trade. And I've, my whole life, I've been looking for a book that really dug in and figured out the economics of slave trade. This guy did a fabulous thing. It's called The Half Has Never Been Told. And basically, based on his research, my assessment is there are two reasons we canceled slavery. One was that the city of London kept losing money because they would finance slaves, but then they couldn't perfect the collateral. So the plantation owner would just sell the slaves west and you couldn't find them. So you would have collateral, but you couldn't perfect it. And so if there was a default, you couldn't grab the slave. Okay. Now with chipping, you can.
That's true.
You know, we have just created the technology that solves that problem. That's number one. Number two, you know, the Haiti revolt, multiple European countries tried to put down the slave army and the Haitians beat them back every time. I think it's one of the reasons you're watching. If you look at what's going on in Haiti, it's definitely payback.
Definitely.
You know, this is European payback. So, and I think that's one of the reasons they were so grateful to the Clintons, because they engineered, you know, the ultimate payback. Anyway, so, or they were part of it. They led it. They put the lipstick on the genocide.
Oh, major. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you look at what's happened technologically, their reasons against overt slavery have been taken away. Now, in my experience, if you look at the top leadership in the central banking warfare model, they absolutely believe in slavery. They practice it. I mean, that's what the whole mind control thing was, because the most efficient slave is somebody who doesn't know they're one. Okay?
No question.
And you know, so if you can literally get a president who's mind controlled and chipped, you're home free.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the reality. We have a group of people running the central banking system. They believe in slavery. They now have the chipping technology to do it. You know, they're marketing with, oh, transhumanism is wonderful.
Right.
And now we're going to give them the ability to force every country into the central banking warfare model and destroy cash. Well, where do you think that's going?
I'd hate to ask.
That's a slavery system. It's a global slavery system. And you throw entrainment technology and subliminal programming and all the other mind control stuff on, and we're talking about slaves in La La Land. I mean, it's really zombie nation.
Well, that is a dark scenario.
It's very, very dark. And, you know, most people cannot fathom that the leadership wants to do this. They can't fathom it. I don't know how to help them fathom it, but we really need to understand these people believe in slavery and they will implement it. They are implementing it, and the digital cash is at the heart of it. Now, in deference to a lot of people that are helping them implement the digital cash system, if you look at what globalization wants, you know, the emerging markets want to come in and trade globally. We all want to trade globally. To do that, we need to bring the financial transaction costs way, way down.
Oh, yeah.
And part of the pressure to do this is not demonic. Part of the pressure to do this is how to make a really efficient economic trading system. You know, and it can be done without it being centralized. So there are absolute ways for everything to work, with the Russians having their own and we having their own, and, you know, and many blockchain is one of the things that can make that happen. But the reality is you know, the guys at the top of the food chain want a highly centralized control model. And my guess is it's because they're dealing with risks, you know, related to planetary risk issues, whether it's the planet's dying and so we have to get to Mars, or we're dealing with other civilizations, you know, whatever the truth of that big mystery is of the governance system, they're risk managers. And so the question for all of us is, if we're going to reach a truly imaginative transformation, how can we help them effectively deal with their risk issues, but still get a bottom-up optimization and still have enough transparency so that we can function without fake everything? Because I don't know about you, you know, this fake stuff is really...
It's just getting too fake out there. Catherine, we'll take a deeper look at this other civilization and the four scenarios that you've outlined for our future in your latest Solari report, which is very compelling. And I'm getting smarter by the minute just thinking about it. Now, we've got the final round of part two with Solari's Catherine Austin Fitz coming up. Everyone, stay with us.
Dark journalist. Go for truth in 2017. The deepest questions. The biggest secrets. The darkest mysteries. Dark journalist. Go for truth. With top guests like Graham Hancock.
Graham, how do we as a society escape the grip of the deep state in the 21st century?
Rather than spending trillions of dollars every year on building up our armies and our weapons of mass destruction and creating a climate of hatred and fear and suspicion, we should be uniting as a human race.
Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, what is the issue that's holding us back and destroying prosperity?
We have a system which is got a negative return on investment, it's killing human productivity, and where it's going is inhuman.
Dark journalist, go for truth. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special spring discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll receive exclusive member benefits, including access to the complete high-quality audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, and subscriber-only content, including bonus show material. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, this is the year. Now is the time.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Join us now and go for truth.
And we are back. This is Dark Journalist, and I'm speaking with former Assistant Secretary of Housing, Catherine Austin Fitz. Now, Catherine is a financial expert, and you can find her fascinating analysis at Solari.com. She has managed over $300 billion in assets during her career. But even more important, she's always been curious about the real governance structure here on planet Earth. And I refer to her Solari reports as Solari University because there's so much to learn there, and I can't imagine a better resource, really. And especially in this crucial period of time, you know, there's something special in this year's report in that she's putting together these scenarios, four different scenarios for our future, and they make very compelling reading. Now, Catherine, I'm always telling people about your wrap-ups, and, you know, I say that they're about 2 years ahead of the headlines generally. But in your own words, tell us how you see the Solari report.
Well, in terms of helping people understand the dynamics that are going to drive their own time and money, I try to stay about 2 years ahead because it takes someone... So, for example, when we did the big space annual report last year, it takes somebody a couple of years to kind of acclimate and figure out how to put it in their paradigm and what it means to their lives, their income statement, their balance sheet. So I want to give them enough heads up so that they can come to grips and really integrate that big dynamic. One was space. One was the shift from global 2.0 to 3.0. It's interesting. You know, last night on Money and Markets on the Solari Report, I went through the latest news on the shift from 2.0. So one money manager had put out a report on which companies are going to be destroyed by Amazon that are publicly traded and in your portfolio. I don't know if you've seen Amazon stock. It looks like a moonshot. And if you look at these other companies, their stock looks like a, you know, the Challenger.
Right.
So You know, but it's a perfect example of 2.0 to 3.0. And then, of course, we were discussing one of the big investment banks came out with a report that said, well, you know, asteroid mining is economic and it makes a lot of sense, particularly when you look at, you know, I just came back from a mining conference in Toronto. And basically what all the miners said is, okay, we're going, you know, to more remote places to dig up more rock to get less metal. So the costs of mining on Earth and getting a yield are dramatic. So here we have a leading investment bank saying, well, you know, asteroid mining really is economic, and this is really going to be a good investment.
Wow.
Right. So, you know, but if you've been reading the wrap-ups, then you're acclimated to these changes, and you're ready to really say, okay, well, what does that mean to me, and what do I want to do about it? And to do it without stress. So one of my goals is to be ahead. The other is to make sure people are on top of things right now. So, for example, you saw in this year's annual wrap-up, we did the scenario design. And, you know, for many years, I've been saying, it's just going to slow burn. Just calm down. It's just going to slow burn. And this year, I got to the wrap-up, and I said, all bets are off.
So
the scenario design took an enormous amount of time and effort for our whole team, mm-hmm. you know, to come down to, okay, what are the scenarios? Because for investment strategy or any kind of personal or business strategy, I'm a great believer that you can't predict the future. But what, you know, I think we're all responsible to invent the future. But as risk managers for our family or business, we have to plan for the fact, you know, that it could go a lot of different ways. And in my entire life, I have never been in a world where the possible scenarios were so many.
Huh.
You know, and part of it is that the Mr. Global governance system continues to be a bit of a mystery.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with just incredible change and uncertainty. And so the scenarios are to really help you bring it down to ground and say, okay, how do I frame and deal with this uncertainty? And then for, you know, the allocation of my time or my assets, how do I be a prudent risk manager? You know, what drives my diversification? And so the scenarios are designed to help you really be on top of what's happening right now. And the other thing is, one of my favorites is News Trend and Stories. Every week at the website, we have a top picks editor, and we're putting up the stories that we think are important according to the deepest trends. And then that aggregates to a database of what's going on for the full quarter. And it's organized around what we think are the important trends. And it's amazing, Daniel, because I always think, you know, I know what's going on. And then we aggregate and play with that database, and I'm like, wow, I didn't see this. You know, things emerge from just mining that data. And so it's a way of helping you stay on top of the news mm-hmm. with very little of your time. Because I have to tell you, the news is overwhelming.
No question.
I know what our little team has to do to pull together those topics and then emerge them into the news trends and stories. And this is literally so a very successful, you know, professional or money manager can just zip through the news trends and stories and know that they didn't miss anything. They got a beat on current events with very little of their time, which is important because they're busy and they need to focus. You know, my clients need to focus on playing with their children.
Yeah.
That's what they need to focus on. And, you know, not watching Donald Trump take U-turns.
I know they're going to get dizzy if they keep up with that.
Right.
Well, let's talk about your scenarios, because I can actually weave this into our whole conversation. One of them, well, there's four. There's the Popsicle Index rising, global musical chairs, mind control, and the war machine. It seemed like there was an even chance for all four of these. It seems like four, the war machine is suddenly coming into view, though.
Yeah, right now we're in war machine. I mean, if we were to take this last 2 weeks, the war machine looks like it's the dominant. And that's basically we're going with a unipolar world and a negative return on investment to taxpayers. So now if you look at the economics of Donald Trump trying to do Make America Great Again and the alternative, you know, you can't do both.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to hit the skids when you get to the budget. He's got his first budget coming out in May. He's done a budget blueprint, but his OMB director was on board for about a week when that came out. So I don't give that a lot of credence. So when his budget comes out in May, that's going to really tell us, are we going to do the unipolar model or are we going to do the multipolar model? You know, which is it? And it'll be interesting to see.
And unipolar would be basically this Anglo alliance with maybe America calling the shots.
Well, it's not America calls the shots. Think of America as the military arm for the G7.
Okay.
So G7 and sort of the central banking warfare model at the, you know, and of course, the governance mystery is who's on top. But the central banking model, central banking warfare model is going to stay dominant. And if you look at the group that's, you know, run it for the last umpty-ump years, they're going to stay in control running it from a very centralized basis. I don't know if, have you had Patrick Wood on the Dark Journalist yet?
Not yet. No, he is interesting.
Patrick Wood wrote a book called Technocracy Rising, which is absolutely excellent. I reviewed it on Solari and I want to get him on. And what he described was the effort to run within the central banking model to run the system based on rules as opposed to different pricing systems that optimize. So I would describe democracy and markets as a way of optimizing. Now, for markets and democracy to work, they need transparency because you need the pricing mechanism to work if you're going to optimize. Well, what these guys decided to do, particularly with the power of digital systems, is to say, no, we're not going to use markets and democracy. We're going to pretend we're doing markets and democracy, but we're going to use rules. And the reality is that the rule system is not working.
Right.
And one of the pushbacks you're seeing in Europe and with Donald Trump's election is people, you know, the productive people saying our productivity is being destroyed by this highly complex bullshit rule system. You know, no, it's the scream of the productive. I don't know if you read my article after the election where I was trying to explain to everybody what had really happened, and I called it the productivity backlash. And that's why the regulatory relief is so important, because this rule system ain't working.
I see.
And Woods nailed it that it's not an accident, it's a plan. Hmm. And that's why the pushback against the Obama administration was so great, because if you look at what the Obama administration was layering on, if that continued, you know, if the Navy is really running thin, for the Navy running thin, instead of to being restoring its basic operational capacity, for them to spend globally time to make sure every sailor has transgender training, you know, that's the end.
Mm-hmm.
That's the end of reserve currency, because your Navy either has to police the sea lanes or it can do transgender training, but it can't do both.
Right.
And if it does transgender training, I got to tell you, morale is going to break down. So,
yeah. It is interesting. There's that other scenario that you have, which is mind control, and that goes into that a little bit. It's got that transhumanist flavor.
It was a mind control. It's basically a mind, you know, if you can get people to behave in, you're a sailor and your job is to police the sea lanes. To do that, you need a certain kind of equipment or ship. You don't have what you need to do your fundamental job. But meantime, you want to stop trying to do your fundamental job and do something else that in the scheme of doing the basic thing is not a priority. You know, that is something that just totally messes with people's minds. Whatever it is, it's not, you know.
I know you're not singling out the transgender theme as much as, you know, these different groups and lifestyles being manipulated to become flashpoints in society to create a divisive atmosphere. So that's something that they're just a master at. Just amazing. Catherine, absolutely fascinating. And your insights about the intense clash of sometimes invisible forces, like the deep state, like this X factor, this other civilization, is just very powerful. And we'll end part one here and go into part two on how the deep state is arranging things to reshape our world and the kind of dangerous roulette that they're playing with the war card. Dark Journalist subscribers will receive part two in their inbox this week. And part two on the deep state with Joseph Farrell also coming up So now's the time to subscribe at darkjournalist.com. Catherine, your latest report, Global Harvest and What It Means to Investors, is available at Solari.com. Just mind-bending and expanding stuff. Thank you so much for being here with us today. And let's go ahead and do part two.
Oh, it's great to be back. You've been doing great stuff.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode on Black Budget Wars, the Deep State, Trump, and North Korea Roulette, with former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Catherine Austin Fitz. You can find more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Subscribe to our newsletter at darkjournalist.com to stay updated on the latest shows.